This is Peter Johnson, introducing again the Catholic Heritage Program broadcasting from England, bringing you traditions, trips, and stories from our Catholic past and inspiration for our Catholic future. Down the centuries, thousands of Christian girls have been baptized with the name Anne or Anna. It's a popular name, one that has been given to princesses and queens. Joanna Bogle, aided by some schoolchildren from a London suburb, has been finding out.
The children of the Sacred Heart Primary School in New Malden, Surrey, reciting the opening lines of a very old poem about St. Anne. St. Anne, St. Anne, she sits in the sun, as fair as a lily, as white as a swan. Who was St. Anne, and why does she sit in the sun? St. Anne is the name that the Church has given to the mother of the Blessed Virgin Mary. It's the same name as Hannah, a very old Jewish name. Anne's name isn't mentioned in the scriptures, and nor is that of her husband, Joachim. The feast of St. Joachim and St. Anne is the 26th of July. That's why St. Anne was said to sit in the sun, because the 26th of July is right in the middle of the summer, the warmest part of the year. The story of St. Anne and St. Joachim clearly has some scriptural links to that of Hannah in the Old Testament. Hannah was childless until, in quite late life, she bore Samuel. Anne and Anna, as I said, are the same names as Hannah, and clearly there's a link with the motherhood that she gave to the Blessed Virgin Mary. The most important aspect of St. Anne's life is that, of course, it was she who taught Mary her first prayers. This is something that was a very popular idea in the early church and throughout medieval England, the importance of a mother's role in the spiritual formation of her children. We have very early church documents that refer to St. Anne, and throughout medieval times, images of St. Anne teaching the Virgin Mary to read, to form her letters, and particularly to pray the Psalms from a little book of the Psalms, were extremely popular. We see this in stained glass, woodcuts and engravings and statues. And incidentally, these prove that it is not true when people try to claim that in medieval times little girls were not educated. It's clear that they were meant to be educated, and that's why pictures and images of St. Anne educating the Virgin Mary and teaching her to read were regarded as quite normal. They reflected a local culture. The name Anne was very much linked to that of her daughter Mary, giving us names like Mary Anne, Anne Marie, Marianne. Even the legendary wife of the legendary Robin Hood, the outlaw, was named Maid Marian. Linking Mary and Anne together in this way was a way of making an important statement about the crucial part played by the Virgin Mary in our redemption history, and the part played by St. Anne, her mother, in forming and educating her for that task. There are lots of churches dedicated to St. Anne across Europe. She's patron saint of Brittany. In England, shrines to St. Anne were quite common, and there was one near the River Thames at an important ford or crossing place. There is still a church standing there today dedicated to St. Anne, but it only dates back to the beginning of this century. Before the Reformation, this shrine at Caversham, near Reading, was a very important one, used by travellers in the days when transport was much harder to acquire and journeys took several days and were often fraught with dangers. This shrine was a place of refuge, a place where you stopped to pray at this particular crossing point on your journey. St. Anne was thus the patron saint of travellers on this particular trip across the Thames. At the Reformation, the shrine of St. Anne at Caversham was completely destroyed, and all the beautiful gifts that had been given over the years were distributed and taken away and used to enrich the plunderers. When the church was restored at the beginning of this century, A beautiful statue of St. Anne was brought from Europe and enthroned in the church. It's still there to this day, and unusually, the church, even though it's a comparatively modern building, has a medieval feel to it, including a window on an outer wall with a shutter which can be opened from the outside, and a kneeler on the outside wall, so that you can kneel there, open the shutter, and pray to St. Anne for your journey, just as medieval people would have been able to do, making a visit to St. Anne, even though the church is locked. That rhyme again, St. Anne, she sits in the sun. Victorian and 18th century versions of that rhyme say Queen Anne, referring to the Stuart Queen who ruled our country in the 18th century. But the rhyme is much older than that. Poor Queen Anne was never a particularly popular queen in Britain, and she had a very sad life, bearing a number of children, all of whom died in infancy. She suffered from dropsy and was in poor health all her life. Certainly the rhyme goes much further back than poor Queen Anne. It's a medieval rhyme going back to the days before the Reformation, and like so many other old traditions, was adapted by a Protestant nation to refer to something Protestant, in this case, poor Queen Anne. The idea of St. Anne has always been popular among Catholics, and devotion to her is still strong today. A League of St. Joachim and St. Anne has recently been founded in Britain, picking up that particular theme of St. Anne passing on a religious formation to her daughter. Josephine Robinson, of the Association of Catholic Women, was one of the founders of the League of St. Anne, so I asked her all about it.
Well, we were challenged by a very distinguished biblical scholar and priest, Father Bernard Orchard, and he said to us, "You're Catholic women, what are you doing about vocations?" Well, of course, we weren't really doing anything about vocations except saying the odd prayer. So we started talking about it, and some people said, "Well, what we want are good, stable families," and somebody else said, "What we want is really good Catholic teaching in schools." And then we started thinking about how difficult it is to pass on the faith to the next generation, particularly in a society like ours, which is so secular and basically pretty anti-Christian. And then we thought about the statues of St. Anne teaching Mary, when she was a little girl, the Book of the Psalms. You see Mary holding the Book of the Psalms and her mother teaching her. And we thought this was a perfect picture of passing on the faith to the next generation. And then we brought in St. Joachim, St. Anne's husband, because they were a married couple, and again, married couples are a good example to us. So we thought we would ask people in the name of St. Anne and St. Joachim to offer Holy Mass on one day a month, preferably not a day of obligation, for all those who try to pass on the Catholic faith to the next generation. And we composed a prayer to St. Anne and St. Joachim. I want to hear that prayer in a bit, but how do people join? What's the commitment? There's no commitment apart from this. I mean, we said this was a league without AGMs, without subscriptions, without bother. It was just a personal commitment to this immensely important work. We are hoping to have a votive mass of St. Anne and St. Joachim one day a year, and we're hoping to send round reminders to churches where we know that we have, people have taken it up. But I wrote an article about it in one of the Catholic papers here, and immediately we got requests for 400 of our little cards. We've had them done, very nice laminated credit card size cards on nice bright orange paper. And other people will have copied the prayer, and we hope circulated it among their friends. And I've sent it, and our other members too have sent it to friends in America, in Ireland, in Africa. So one hopes that it is getting around.
Have you had support from the bishops on this?
Well, we haven't contacted all the bishops in England and Wales, but we did write to Cardinal Basil Hume, who died recently and for whom we're praying. And he wrote back a charming letter saying he was delighted to hear that we were praying in this way. So we felt that was a great encouragement to us.
And now, let's hear the prayer of the League of St. Anne and St. Joachim.
St. Anne and St. Joachim, who guided the Maid of Israel and taught her the prayers of God the Father, she in turn taught her Divine Son. we ask you to pray for all who seek to pass on the faith to the next generation. The Holy Father, bishops, priests and religious, teachers, parents, grandparents, and others, that they may live it and teach it with love and humility, with clarity and with courage, so that young people will remain steadfast, and that many will offer themselves directly to God as priests and religious in response to his call.
Ancient hilltop city of St Albans can be reached easily from London, only a short 21-mile train journey to the northwest. Verulamium, as it is known to the Romans, was once the third largest city in Britain, settled before London was founded. It is still in a good state of preservation, as Tim Matthews now reports.
In AD 293, Alban, a Roman citizen of Verulamium, was martyred on a hill here, and so gave the town its new name. In his ecclesiastical history, St. Bede the Venerable tells us something about England's first martyr. St. Alban, he said, born in fertile Britain's land, suffered during the reign of Diocletian. While still a pagan, he gave shelter to a Christian priest who was fleeing from his persecutors. And when Alban saw the holy man spending so much time in prayer, he was touched by the grace of God. Moved by the priest's example, Alban began to emulate his faith and devotion, and in the course of time he thoroughly imbibed the priest's salutary teaching, renounced the darkness of idolatry, and wholeheartedly professed the Christian faith. Soon, however, word got out that Alban was sheltering a Christian, and when the soldiers arrived to search the house, Alban dressed himself in the priest's clothes and gave himself up in the place of his guest and his teacher. The judge was so annoyed that Alban should have surrendered himself in place of his guest that, when he refused to offer sacrifice to idols, ordered him to be scourged in the hope that he could shake his constancy by torture. But Alban bore all his severe torments with joyful patience for Christ's sake. When the judge saw that no torture could break him or induce him to repudiate his faith in Christ, he ordered him to be beheaded. St. Alban suffered on the 22nd day of June near the city of Verulamium. And, concludes Bede, when the peace of Christian times was restored, a beautiful church worthy of his martyrdom was built there. The Romans first came here in AD 43, and over the years their settlement prospered, and by the time of Nero it was a self-governing city. You can see many of the Roman remains in Verulamium Park by the River Ver today. You can still see their theatre, which is the only Roman theatre in Britain known to have had a stage, at the rear of which are traces of dressing rooms. The tiered seats, grouped in a semicircle, 150 feet across, are now grassed over. The theatre is open daily. Other Roman remains can be seen in the nearby museum, which is also open all year. So in 429, St. Germanus held a synod here to confute the Pelagian heresy, that heresy that still unfortunately affects us, and shortly after which the town fell into the hands of the Saxons. It was retaken by the Britons, but then once again the Saxons returned, and it was when the town lay in ruins after these battles that Offa, king of Mercia, founded the first abbey of plank and wood on the site of St. Alban's martyrdom. Matthew Paris, who was a monk in the town, says that in 950 a church was built on each of the three main roads which led to the town, and modern St. Albans grew up round these three churches. The original abbey, founded here by King Offa, fell into ruins around the time of the Norman conquest, and a second abbey was built, and except for its church, also fell into ruins. The existing church, built by Abbot Paul of Caen, and subsequently extended, dates from mainly about 1093. Pope Adrian IV constituted the Benedictine abbot of St. Albans, the first abbot in England in order and dignity, and Pope Honorius in 1218 exempted the abbot from the jurisdiction of the Bishop of Lincoln. One of the earliest printing presses in the country was established at the abbey. St. Thomas More said that he'd like to live and die at St. Albans. Unfortunately, the abbey was very badly over-restored in the 19th century. The architect Lord Grimsthorpe substituted inappropriate early English style for the original Norman style. Indeed, the restoration was such a disaster that it was one of the cases that in the 1870s led to the foundation of the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings. The four-square tower of what is now St. Albans Cathedral was built of bricks removed from the Roman ruins of Verulamium. Inside its nave, 275 feet, is the longest in England. At the heart of the church stood the shrine of St. Albans. A list of its benefactors, the Golden Register, is still preserved in the British Museum. Matthew Parry said he had never seen a shrine more splendid and noble. It was then in the form of an altar tomb with a lofty canopy over it, supported by four pillars. The figure of the saint lay on it in state. The shrine enclosed the coffin in which the 16th century abbot had placed the saint's relics. On two sides of the enclosed coffin was ornamented with figures embossed in gold and silver, portraying the main events in the saint's life. At the head was a large crucifix, with a figure of Our Lady on one side and St. John on the other, all ornamented with jewels. In front of the choir was another statue of Our Lady, seated on a throne and holding her son, the work being richly embossed with gold and enriched with precious stones and costly bracelets. The four supporting pillars were shaped like towers, with little windows, all being of plate gold. The inside of the canopy was encrusted with crystals. At the dissolution of the monasteries, this lovely shrine was demolished. But in the 19th century, when a wall was being knocked down, some part of the shrine's pillars were uncovered and reassembled. The church itself was bought by a Mr. Stump for £400, and to his credit and the credit of the inhabitants, it was converted into their parish church. The old lady chapel was converted into a school. The gateway of the old monastic building still remains. The Fighting Cock's Inn, which claims to be the oldest licensed inn in the country, was connected to the monastery by a tunnel and may have served the monks as a fishing lodge. In later years it became a venue for cockfighting, and the cockpit still stands. By the time of the dissolution, St. Albans had been governed by no less than 41 abbots. In 1402 a clock tower was built nearby, and it still contains the curfew bell that dates from 1335, and opposite the clock tower is the waxhouse gate, where candles were made for pilgrims visiting the shrine. St. Michael's Church was founded in the middle of the 10th century, but in the walls you can still see speckles of red Roman brick. St. Peter's was built on the site of an earlier Saxon church, while the ruins of a nunnery, founded in 1140, are to be found to the southeast. King Henry VIII is said to have been married to Anne Boleyn in its chapel. Lady Julia Berners, who, rather surprisingly for a nun, wrote treatises on hunting, hawking, brass armour and heraldry, was once one of its superiors.
As part of a European initiative, an Ancients Pilgrim Route is being signposted and laid out in the Hampshire County Council in the south of England. The route leads from the cathedral city of Winchester, once the capital of England, to the naval port of Portsmouth. It will then link up with a similar route in France, leading to the Norman sanctuary of Mont Saint-Michel, and Tim Matthews now reports.
the first stage of a route which in time will be extended from Mont-Saint-Michel in France to reach Santiago de Compostela in Spain, thus reopening one of the oldest routes of pilgrimage in Europe. The revived Pilgrim's Trail, which initially cuts through a number of picturesque Hampshire villages and country towns in the south of England before reaching the English Channel, will be clearly marked and open to anyone to follow after its launch in September 1999. The walk will enable local people and visitors to follow short sections of the clearly designated Pilgrim's Trail, or to walk its entire length over a longer period of time. Reviving the route will provide walkers with an opportunity to explore the hidden villages and byways which once linked the ancient capital of Winchester and its shrine to St. Swithin with the busy seaport at Portsmouth, where ships would take pilgrims across the Channel to France. In the olden days, pilgrims from all over England would have gathered at Winchester to begin their pilgrimage, starting by visiting the shrine of St. Swithin in the cathedral. In the Lady Chapel in the cathedral, you can still see a statue of a pilgrim carved on the end of one of the stalls. St. Swithin was the prior of the old minster here, and he asked to be buried out of doors. And when his bones were removed inside the cathedral, it rained for 40 days, non-stop. In the cathedral, there was also an altar dedicated to St. Christopher, the patron saint of pilgrims. On the eastern side of the cathedral close is the surviving portion of Pilgrim's Hall, supposed to have been used to accommodate pilgrims. After going to confession in Winchester, the pilgrims would probably have got themselves badges and lead ampullae, those are flasks of holy water, to take with them as they set out on their journey. The pilgrims will set out passing through the 13th century city wall, which actually was originally built by the Romans, and then the route passes close by Wolsey Castle, the palace of the bishops of Winchester, which was built around 1130. The ruins are open to the public. Beyond the castle, you can look out across the water meadows to the Hospital of St. Cross, Britain's oldest charitable organisation, which was founded by William the Conqueror's grandson. Anglican services are still held daily in its Norman church, and the hospital is open all year, but not on Sundays. Between Winchester and Bishop's Waltham, the medieval landscape was largely arable and downland. Today it remains open, although some medieval field patterns can still be seen. As the trail approaches Bishop's Waltham, it follows, for a short distance, something called a lug. A lug is an earth bank or ditch that once kept deer in the Bishop of Winchester's deer park. It's the only deer park in the county that's mentioned in Domesday, and it may date from the 10th century. The bishop's palace at Bishop's Waltham was originally, in 1135, on the site of a cemetery, but it was rebuilt between 1160 and 1180 on a more ambitious scale. Only a fragment remains today, but it is open to the public between April and October. South of Bishop's Waltham, the pilgrims pass through the Forest of Bear, owned largely by the king and the church, a fact reflected in many of the local place names, Bishop Woods Road, Kingsmead. Beyond the Kingsmead is Southwick, where there was once a house of Augustinian canons, founded before 1128 by William de Pont de Larche and dedicated to Our Lady. The priory moved to Southwick from Borchester Castle around 1150. It was suppressed at the dissolution of the monasteries in 1538. Little of it survives, although there are traces of the old monastic fish ponds. Material from the monastery was used later in rebuilding the village church, once called St. James Without the Priory Gate. It's probable that the pilgrims of olden days would have visited this church, since they were on the way to St. James's own shrine at Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Southwick, by the way, is renowned for its role in the D-Day landings in June 1944, and the famous D-Day map room is in Southwick House. In Portsmouth, it's time to take the ferry to France, on your way to the port of Cherbourg, then to Barfleur, and then on to Mont-Saint-Michel in Normandy. The Royal Garrison Church in Portsmouth is the site of a medieval hospital for pilgrims. If you decide to follow the Pilgrim's Trail, its waymarks are based on the silhouette of Mont-Saint-Michel in France and include the shell and walking stick long associated with pilgrimages to Santiago de Compostela. In England, the signs are green. In France, they are blue. This is Tim Matthews for EWTN Global Catholic Network.
You've enjoyed this look at some of our Catholic heritage. There'll be more next time, so we hope you'll join us then. If you have any comments or snippets of history or information, do write to me, Peter Johnson, at Catholic Heritage, EWTN Global Catholic Radio, 1500 High Road, Vandiver, that's Vandiver, Alabama, USA, 35176. Or you can email us at radio@ewtn.com.